from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today we'll revisit some of our recent interviews about great museum exhibits to check out in Indy this summer.
I'll start by going to another galaxy far, far away with Star Wars at the State Museum.
Then I'll go to my jam session at the Idlejord Guitars exhibit.
Then we'll wrap it up with Ai Weiwei at the IMA. Plus, it'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. From a galaxy far, far away comes an exhibit unlike any other to the Indiana State Museum, Star Wars. Travis DiNicola spoke with Tracy Cromwell, Director of Collections, to find out more.
Tracy, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. So this is pretty exciting. I mean, this is just an extremely cool exhibit I've been hearing about for a while. I know you guys have been excited about it coming here. Before we get into everything that is so cool about the Star Wars exhibit, though, just help me understand a little bit, not that I'm complaining, but what does a Star Wars exhibit have to do with the Indiana State Museum?
Well, this particular Star Wars exhibit deals with the science, engineering, and robotics that are used in all six Star Wars movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, a lot of that robotics and engineering and science technology is being used and researched at many universities here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we are working with Rose Holman in particular in the robotics department to do a lot of lectures and programs during the run of the Star Wars exhibit.
Very cool. Okay. And really, I mean, the State Museum is an educational organization.
Yes.
And the exhibits that you guys have are not necessarily all limited to just, you know, a narrow interpretation of Indiana history or culture.
No, part of our mission is bringing the culture and science and technology of the world to Indiana as well. So we don't want to just talk about Indiana history and stay stuck on that. We want to bring the world to Indiana.
And or bring a galaxy from far, far away to Indiana, I suppose.
Yes, in this case.
Okay, so let's talk about the exhibit, because this is just really fun. How was this exhibit put together? I mean, this was all done by Lucasfilms and museum curators, or you know, is it like a package deal, or do you guys get some say in the involvement of this, or how does that all work?
Actually, it's a traveling exhibit that was put together by the Museum of Science Boston several years ago.
Okay.
All of the artifacts and technology in the exhibit are borrowed from Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm.
So they put together this exhibit with the help of Lucasfilm, and it has been traveling the world for 6 years now.
Okay.
And we're one of the last two venues to get it.
And do you get like some opportunity to, within the exhibit itself, I mean, you're talking about the work, you know, certainly with the universities, but within the exhibit itself, do you have, you know, some opportunity to sort of personalize it for Indiana? A little, not much.
Really at all. We're going to do that through a lot of our programming.
I see.
Like I said, with Rose Holman lectures and any summer camps that we're doing for kids, really through the programming, we're going to drive that Indiana component.
Sure. And that makes a lot of sense. So the exhibit includes, among other really cool artifacts and things, the opportunity to actually sit inside the Millennium Falcon. Is that right?
Yes. It's called the Millennium Falcon Experience. It is a separate component of the exhibit that will be in our main lobby of the museum.
Okay.
It's rather huge. It's a dome theater component. Mm-hmm. So you are experiencing riding in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon.
So it's the cockpit, not the whole Millennium Falcon.
Not the whole Millennium Falcon. But it's still rather large, mm-hmm, and four people get to sit in the pilot and the co-pilot chairs, and you watch through the window of the Millennium Falcon a sort of journey through the galaxy narrated by C-3PO.
That's so fun.
It is fun.
Oh, cool. And then there's also another component where there's Luke Skywalker's land speeder. Is that right?
Yes, it's his actual land speeder as part of the exhibit, as well as the actual little miniature model of the land speeder with Ken dolls inside, dressed up as Luke Skywalker. And then also an interactive next to that land speeder where people can experience how it felt to ride in the land speeder.
That's got to be so cool.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Now, you've seen this exhibit on at other museums, is that?
Yes, mm-hmm. I went in the fall to see it at the Orlando Science Center, who currently has it right now, and it closes in a week and a half, I believe.
Okay, so and then coming straight from there to here.
And then it travels here, mm-hmm. And we will have it installed and ready by May. May 25th, the exhibit opens, and we do get the Millennium Falcon experience up and running a little bit before then.
Very fun. Now, are you a Star Wars fan yourself?
I remember going to see the first movie when I was a small child, but I wasn't a huge fan. My husband is a huge, huge Star Wars fan, so I know about it through him.
You've become a fan.
I've become a huge fan because you have to learn so much when you get an exhibit like this. There's so much terminology and all of these different aspects of the movies you need to learn, and the characters and lines that people say, and it's a lot to learn, and I really do enjoy it now.
So, I mean, the science part of this, and I don't mean to sound skeptical, but, you know, since the world of Star Wars is in a galaxy far, far away, and you know, there's questions about, you know, are the rules of physics even the same in the world of Star Wars? I mean, how does that science transfer in a way that people will get something out of this exhibit other than that, oh, that's just a really cool model factor?
Well, one cool section of the exhibit is talking about the medical aspects used in the movies. And so you can sort of see how robots are used mm-hmm. to do surgeries, like when Luke's hand is cut off by Darth Vader.
Right, okay.
And he gets a replacement robotic hand. And it's all done with robots doing the surgery. And surgeries do happen today where a doctor doesn't actually touch you. Robots do all of the work. It's great cutting-edge technology that happens even here in this state.
Have you found that I mean, George Lucas, in his work in creating these films, was relying on, you know, actual technology and science, maybe just accelerated a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it seems like he did enough research and has this vast knowledge of so many different aspects that are then rolled into the movies, from science and technology to art and mm-hmm. costume design and all of these aspects, that he had a hand in making these movies happen. It's just incredible.
So what's your favorite part of the exhibit? Can you pick anything specific? Or?
I like the Wampa.
The Wampa? Tell me about that.
The Wampa is sort of the abominable snowman that lives on the planet Hoth.
Yeah, okay.
And he is trying to eat Luke as a snack before Han Solo barges in and saves him from the Wampa. But I really like the Wampa.
You know, I totally forgot that was the name of that creature. I mean, and you say you're not a fan. You're a fan. You know the Wampa.
I've always liked him, but now I know more about
now
him.
Now you know more about the Wampa. So how's that work? Is there like a small miniature model of the Wampa? Is there a big Wampa?
A lot of the exhibit is the actual costumes and props used in the movie. So mm-hmm. there is the actual Wampa costume that someone wore in the movie, mm-hmm. As well as Chewbacca and other Wookiees and Han Solo and Darth Vader and Yoda puppet and Padme's costume and different things from all six of the movies.
You know, a big part of putting on museum exhibits, of course, is creating models. And I would have to think that, I mean, a lot of the curators and staff at the State Museum just got to be so excited about seeing some of these models because of the intricacy of the details.
Yeah, I've learned how many employees at the State Museum are true closet Star Wars fans. I have never had so many people offer to help me with my work before.
Listen, that's great. What a bonus.
Yeah, it is. But I think everybody is so excited about this exhibit at the museum. From every component we're doing, we're doing an additional Star Wars gift shop, the programming mm-hmm. that I've told you about, just the exhibit itself, we have so many people at work that are excited and want to get the word out to as many people as possible to come see this.
That's really cool. That's a lot of fun. Hey, tell me a little bit more about the programming. So, I mean, you know, especially, I mean, some of the stuff that you're going to be doing with younger kids to you know, sort of share that love of science, technology, engineering, and math with those kids.
Well, we are doing a summer camp. Mm-hmm. It's a sci-fi camp. And it will be a lot of science, technology, a lot of hands-on things for the kids to do, as well as them getting to go through the Star Wars exhibit itself several times and to ride the Millennium Falcon as well. And then we're going to do once a month program days in June and July. Mm-hmm. That kids can come down and do Jedi training and, you know, really experience hands-on things that they can do crafts or face painting and sort of do science-related projects as well during those program days. And I think the one in June is the 20th and July is the 22nd.
I got to say, have you thought about having a summer camp for adults?
We're doing other things for adults.
Okay.
We're doing the weekend of Gen Con.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect. Right. And that's in August, of course.
Right. Mm-hmm. In August, we are doing an adult sort of program day that weekend on Saturday night.
Wow, I bet you guys will be overwhelmed for that.
We're hoping it's a huge party. We want people to come dressed up in their costumes, mm-hmm. whether they're at Gen Con or not at Gen Con, to just come down and experience a Star Wars exhibit and have fun at the party.
Now, this is one of the largest exhibits that's ever come to the State Museum, right?
Yeah, pretty much the closest to this size has been Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And it's pretty equivalent in size. This is maybe a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Well, this is very exciting. Anything you would like to add that we maybe did not get a chance to talk about yet?
We are going to be in the 500 Festival Parade as well,
okay.
which is quite exciting.
Yeah.
We are working with the 501st Legion here in Indiana, and that is a group that does total volunteering and helping out to raise funds for children's groups, but they do it dressed in their Star Wars costumes.
Oh, nice.
So they are going to represent the exhibit and the museum in the 500 Festival Parade for us. So there'll be a large group of Star Wars characters in the 500 Parade.
That's a first. That'll be very fun.
And Darth Vader and Chewbacca will be there as well.
Nice. Now, has anyone asked you to put on a costume yet?
Oh, yes, all the time. I get asked at work to show up in my Princess Leia buns to meetings and things like that, but I'm not going to do it.
Well, and it's funny because, I mean, here you showed up, you know, to the radio station dressed as Chewbacca, but, you know, no one can see it. So
I'm not going to do the Wookiee call for you. Sorry.
Travis DiNicola with the Indiana State Museum's Director of Collections, Tracy Cromwell. To buy tickets, call the museum at 317-232-1637, again, 232-1637, or visit online at indianamuseum.org, indianamuseum.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
More than 100 guitars owned by greats including Roy Rogers, Charlie Christian, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Woody Guthrie, Buddy Holly, Les Paul, and others are on display together for the first time ever at the Idle Jorg Museum. Sharon Gamble invited James Nottage, Vice President and Chief Curatorial Officer, to our studios to talk about guitars, roundups to rockers.
Guitars, roundups to rockers starts with the idea of contradicting what people think about guitars in the West. It's not just cowboys out in the sage, and it's not just Jimi Hendrix sort of thing, but it starts really with the early Spanish settlers in Texas and California, for example, bringing instruments to what we think of as the West in the late 1700s especially, and it comes to today's timeline. There are two parts to the story. One has to do with the inventiveness and the history of especially electric guitars in the West. Fender guitars, Dobros, they're all invented in the West.
I didn't know that.
Etc. But we want to contradict what people think about music in the West. So there's something for everyone in the show. It is cowboy music, but it's also Hawaiian music. It is jazz. It is big bands. It is blues. It's rock and roll. It's punk, grunge, metal. Just about anything you can think of. So we want to broaden people's view of what is a really diverse American West.
This is a unique exhibition in that you're bringing together instruments and collateral that have to do with guitars, not just the instruments themselves, but other items, from multiple collections. Where did the idea for this exhibition start?
Well, it starts with the museum, the Eideldorg Museum's devotion to creating an annual exhibit that really brings people to the museum. When they're here for these shows, they see the rest of the museum. They enjoy our cafe. They see great programs. But we have for 3 years running been increasing visitation, and this is an important example of that. So we created it in-house, and these guitars are coming from the Experience Music Project in Seattle, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Autry National Center, from quite a few performers and collectors. And so none of these as a group have been seen together before. Some have been played on stage together, but just a few examples of that.
And how is the exhibit arranged? Is it chronological or is it thematic? And if so, how? How did you decide what goes with what?
Well, after the introduction, we help introduce people to what a guitar is, the guitar family. It's many types of instruments. We look at that. We provide a wonderful interactive section where people actually pick up guitars and play them if they want.
I love that. A guitar corral. Not a petting zoo, but a corral. Love it.
That's right. Then we look at the history of the technology of the guitar, and then we go through the different genres of music in a sort of chronological fashion.
And guitars came from where before they were in the hands of the Spanish settlers who brought them to the West?
Well, the earliest guitar in our show dates from 1793. It's an Italian example, but there are examples of guitars. The group of instruments is called chordophones, but we have examples from the Mideast, from Italy, from France, etc. But that mature instrument is sort of symbolized by this Italian guitar. German examples, Austrian especially, were influenced by the Italian examples. And from the Middle East, even in other areas, there are instruments that are part of this instrument family.
Was there, in the evolution of the guitar, was there some intent to make something portable that didn't used to be portable?
You know, I actually think that portability is a fairly consistent characteristic of these instruments. Although when visitors come to the show, they're going to see instruments that may not look quite as portable. There's one with 20 strings that seems a little awkward. But that's one of the keys in the Western experience. They are a portable instrument.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever played yourself?
I'm a beginning steel guitar player.
Really?
But that's one of the infectious things about this exhibit. And we, on weekends, we'll be providing our guests with opportunities to interact with guitar instructors and to learn something about playing themselves.
Do you find that certainly a lot of the guitars in the exhibition will be identified with a performer of one particular style? You know,
right.
Somebody's a funk player, somebody's a blues player.
Right.
Not a lot of performers, once they're famous, go back and forth among the genres. But do you find that a lot of performers that you've encountered along the way had to kind of noodle around and try this and try that and try the other before they figured out who they were with the guitar?
It's interesting. You can look at influences on different players, and I hope we provide a lot of good examples of that. One of the most famous guitars in the exhibit is a wonderful Gibson guitar that was played by a remarkable player named Charlie Christian. He was born in Texas, raised in Oklahoma. And in a very short career, he died at 25.
Oh, my gosh.
He was with Benny Goodman's sextet. And he made the guitar a lead instrument and influenced every jazz player from then on. Wes Montgomery from Indianapolis, George Benson. He even influenced Jerry Garcia with the Grateful Dead.
Wow.
So his playing continues to influence players today. And if you look at someone like Jerry Garcia, you can see a wide range of influences on him, including country music, jazz, other forms of music that inspired him. So I find the most innovative players feed from many areas for their inspiration.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your sort of aha, I can't believe we got that one moments in in developing this exhibit?
Well, I have lots of favorites. There are 100 and some in the exhibit. I think one that people of my generation will enjoy is a Gibson SG. It's one of the most famous rock and roll guitars in the world. This is the instrument given by Dickie Betts to Duane Allman, and it was the slide guitar that Allman used in the last couple years of his life on playing with Eric Clapton on the Lila album with Derek and the Dominoes. It's a very prominent instrument. From our local area, we're grateful to Jim Irsay from the Colts for loaning about 10 of his guitars, including a George Harrison guitar and some other very wonderful examples. So, you know, there are just a lot of favorites. One is a Martin guitar from 1837 that may actually have been taken west aboard a covered wagon to Salt Lake City in the 1840s. So that's a favorite. So it covers a lot of ground.
Sure. Yeah. So what is it that the West does differently relative to building guitars, promoting guitars? Mm-hmm. And I, again, always with the Idlejorg, West covers mm-hmm. so many territories and so many entities, but that's kind of the theme of this exhibit.
Well, it is the theme, and as I mentioned earlier, the idea of amplifying the guitar is a big part of the Western story. So in the 1890s, we have a Norwegian immigrant in Port Arthur, Washington, who develops large-bodied hollow-neck guitars that are very useful for Hawaiian playing. Mm-hmm. We have a German-Jewish immigrant named Weisenborn in Los Angeles who develops similar instruments. We have another immigrant in Los Angeles who invents the dobro and resonator guitars, a man named John Dopiera.
Oh, hence dobro. I get it. Somebody who's not familiar, would you describe a dobro?
A dobro is a guitar that has a cone on the inside, a resonator cone that helps to amplify the sound of the instrument.
So a lot of inventiveness.
A great deal of inventiveness. That doesn't mean people in areas other than the West didn't attempt to develop the electric
sure.
guitar. You know, radios and phonographs and telephones helped provide the keys for amplifying instruments, but it was the Rickenbacker Company in Los Angeles that had the earliest electric guitar patents.
And that was about when?
Well, their first instrument, in fact, we have in the exhibit, a 1932 instrument made by what became Rickenbacker that was the first electric guitar played publicly, a production
that
guitar.
Early.
It's the first instrument played in an electric ensemble anywhere in the world.
Whoa.
And we have a recording of it. People can listen to many of these instruments being played as they go through the
cool.
exhibit. But that Rickenbacker is actually one of the most special instruments, and it's just a small little guitar.
But it changed the world.
It did.
Changed the world of guitar playing anyway.
Right. And you find, say, even with the British invasion in the 60s, with groups coming here, they are deeply influenced by American music. And the instruments they use, Fender guitars and Rickenbacker guitars, have a lot to do with their music when they come here.
Let's talk about raw materials. Mm-hmm. So were guitar makers in the West using locally sourced woods, or what was going on there?
Primarily locally sourced woods, but other woods, like rosewood, for example, would have been imported from South America.
For the keyboard?
For bodies also, yes. Some pretty exotic woods are being used.
Yeah. So. You have a lot of programming that supports this exhibition.
We do. Every Saturday we have programming that's available to people of all ages, but we also have concerts starting in April and May, with some very special groups. Folks can find out the details from our website. On second Saturdays of each month, we have additional opportunities to do things. We'll have an artist doing caricatures of guitar playing visitors. we'll provide a forum for local bands to perform. We'll be showing films on those Saturdays, including the Indianapolis premiere of a film called The Wrecking Crew.
Talk to me about that. What is that about?
Well, The Wrecking Crew is an important group of musicians in Los Angeles. In fact, one of the members, we have a very special guitar that was played by Barney Kessel, a very important jazz guitarist, who becomes important to Sessions. So he's in Los Angeles with The Wrecking Crew, adding to the music of everyone from the Mamas and the Papas to the Beach Boys to Nat King Cole. So The Wrecking Crew is a studio group that's a part of the recording industry.
Sweet heritage there. Wow. Yeah. So your steel guitar lessons started at what point in developing this exhibit?
A little bit before.
Oh, okay. Before. Yeah. Will we get to hear you perform at any time?
Not a chance. Not a chance. One of the things that's gratifying, you get to, we publicly hear the phrase Guitar Hero a lot. And by the way, we have the guitar that was used to do all the tracks for Guitar Hero. But you get to have a peek at the talents of individuals who you might like because you like their music, or if you're a player, you might be inspired by their playing. One of my favorite lenders, I have to say, we have six instruments from Vince Gill. Vince is a remarkable talent, and he's one of many Western guitarists. He's born and raised in Oklahoma. We have a lot of Oklahoma guitarists in this show. I don't know if it's something in the water there or what it is. But many of the greats. When you look at someone with his multi-instrument talents, he's a model individual in other ways as well, but they're good choices for guitar heroes.
Sharon Gamble and Idle Jorg Vice President and Chief Curatorial Officer James Nottage. Guitars, Roundups to Rockers features ongoing performances, programs, and all types of stuff, including films, guitar instruction, a guitar corral, and much, much more. You can learn more at idlejorg.org. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Happy 4th of July.
Oh, happy 4th of July to you, too. Did you get me a red, white, and blue cake?
I did. It's just for you with little sparklers that we can
chocolate
light.
Chocolate cake and, inside.
Mm-hmm, of course.
I love it. And we have oral treats for you, our dear listeners, on that calendar we call.
What
will
we
do? It's hard to get the chocolate through the speakers in your radio. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Oh, goodness. So so many fun things going on, of course. A lot of people are off this week for the 4th of July
Indeed.
Holiday, and there's still lots of great stuff to check out. One thing that looks like a lot of fun, the Epilogue Players, they're presenting their production of Agatha Christie's classic mystery, The Mousetrap, through July 21st. That actually opens on July 5th. You can get more information at epilogueplayers.org. Great little downtown theater worth checking out.
Love it. Hey, if you're hearing us on the 4th of July, don't forget, tomorrow is First Friday, Friday, July 5th. And in addition to all the normal gallery hopping that you can take advantage of, the Harrison Center for the Arts is presenting FoodCon 4.
Oh, that'll be
fourth
excellent.
Year in a
I love
row.
That.
Yeah. It's their unconventional celebration of the art and culture of food in Indiana. There will be all kinds of local food enthusiasts, and come curious because you can learn about raising goats and chickens in an urban setting,
what?
About beekeeping, salmon cooperatives.
Oh.
I'm pausing for the full visual effect of salmon cooperatives.
I'm just thinking of what makes a salmon so cooperative.
I don't know. It's probably not marinating it in lemon and soy sauce. Hydroponics, lead abatement, the Garden Tower Project, the Butler Campus Farm, cow share programs. It's your turn to have the cow. Cooperative. Yes, we know what this really means. We're just having fun with you guys. So you can learn about all that. Plus, of course, there's an art exhibit with all sorts of great artists and a mini food truck festival along Delaware Street. West Coast Tacos, Scratch, Duos Indie, Nicey Treat, KG, Slider Station, Scouts Tree Truck, Treats
wow.
Truck, and Spice Box Indie. If you're hearing us Saturday morning and missed this, I'm sorry for the bruise you're getting by kicking yourself.
That sounds like an awful lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cow share.
Cow sharing.
Salmon cooperative.
I remember cow tipping, but I don't
yeah,
remember
I
cow
did.
Sharing.
Yeah, this is a little different.
You mentioned food trucks, Sharon. Well, food trucks are going to be a big part of the treasure hunt coming up next weekend on July 13th. Indiana Landmarks and the Old North Side are putting together an antique and collectible dealers and yard sale treasure hunt that's free, with more than 40 antique and collectible dealers and a lot of food trucks as well, and activities for kids of all ages. You can pick up your treasure hunt map at the Indiana Landmarks Center, which shows you all the different locations where the events are taking place. Again, that's from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on July 13th.
Fabulous. So after you find your treasures at Treasure Hunt that day, that night, you can go relax out by the water at Rick's Cafe Boatyard and hear the Monica Herzig Trio.
Lovely.
Yay, from 6:30 to 10:30 on Saturday night, July 13th. It happens to be Bastille Day Eve. I don't know if the Monica Herzig Trio is going to take any requests for French music or not, but you can certainly ask.
Yeah, it's a great place to hear music, especially sitting out there overlooking the
water. It is so relaxing.
The Carmel Community Players are opening Marvin's Room, opening the door to Marvin's Room, so to speak, July 11th, and then running through July 21st. A very, very funny play that is taking place up there at the Carmel Community Playhouse in Clay Terrace. You can get more information at carmelplayers.org.
Love that. So, a show that's just opening this weekend at the Athenaeum as part of First Friday is called Seven Virtues, and it's presented by the Southport Artistry Council. It's at the Athenaeum, presented by the Southport Artistry Council, and the exhibit is up all month. On Friday the 5th in the evening, there'll be wine and snacks and charity representatives, because a portion of the proceeds from art sales will go to the Julian Center, Habitat for Humanity, Exodus, Hunger Inc., and Little Sisters of the Poor. So that's going on again. It's opening this Friday night, July 5th, at the Athenaeum. The art exhibit is up all month, so you might go see if there is any art you need to own, and know that the proceeds go to some great causes.
Very good. Hey, at the Children's Museum, Rapunzel, Rapunzel, a very hairy fairy tale. That's right, it's a grim one.
Terrible.
It's going to be playing all summer long at the Lilly Theater, which is inside the Children's Museum. And they're going to be transforming that theater into a magical castle, complete with a tall tower where Princess Rapunzel has been trapped by the evil, Lady Zaza. And so this is running through August 4th. And who's going to come to the princess's rescue? Well, you'll have to find out when you check out this 45-minute-long comedy, perfect for children of all ages. They do public performances Tuesday through Sunday at 1 and 3 p.m. as well.
Love that. Hey, a one-tank trip? How about motoring up to Fort Wayne, where the work of Studio Glass pioneer and legend Dale Chihuly will make a return? Chihuly's Secret Garden is going to be certainly a blockbuster exhibition at the Fort Wayne Museum of Art. There's also what's being billed as the Summer of Glass, and that is the 41st International Studio Glass Invitational, which features 26 award winners regarded as the best in the world, will be on display as well. So especially if you're a fan of glass art, think about popping up to Fort Wayne for a day or maybe even the weekend. And there's lots of other great things going on in Fort Wayne as well, including some fabulous restaurants.
A slightly shorter drive will take you to the Palladium in Carmel, where there's a lot of great summer concerts on the schedule, including the Great American Songbook High School Vocal Competition, which is going to be taking place on July 26th. But also, we got Chris Isaac on July 28th. He always gives a great show. Kansas, August 9th, and Smokey Robinson. That should be a lot of fun. August 31st, tickets are available now for all the summer at the Palladium concerts.
Aren't you glad I didn't sing a Kansas song there?
Yes, I did.
Just such an opening. Hey, Footlight Musicals is doing its youth show, and it's Young Frankenstein, or Frankenstein, depending. And the cast is comprises aspiring performers ages 18 to 25, as they're described, and it's Footlight's way of contributing to young performers' opportunities to further hone their artistic abilities. The director is Kathleen Horrigan. You've seen her on stage many times around town. So go check that out, the Footlight Young Adults production, Young Frankenstein, opening July 5th and running for a couple weeks.
Very good. Hey, last thing, I just want to remind you, we've got a couple big festivals coming up fairly soon. One, of course, is the Indiana Black Expo Summer Celebration, which starts July 11th and goes through the 23rd in its 43rd year. And it's a kaleidoscope of programs and all sorts of events and festivals and youth activities and movies and art and sports and always a lot of fun. The other thing I'll also give you a heads up on, Indie Film Fest is in its 10th year, and that will be at the IMA, and that kicks off on July 18th for 10 days of films from all over the world, long and small and short and tall, and should be a lot of fun.
I love it.
Excellent, Sharon. Well, we'll be back next week with more ideas for the calendar we called.
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Ai Weiwei may be one of the most important living artists in the world. He certainly is the most significant contemporary Chinese artist, and his work is coming to the Indianapolis Museum of Art, even if the artist is forbidden to. Travis DiNicola spoke with contemporary curator Sarah Green to learn more.
This is, I think, a really exciting show that we're going to be talking about. Ai Weiwei at the IMA, which, as we just said, is fun to say. You know what's interesting about Ai Weiwei is, for people who know him, they're probably thinking, my gosh, this is great. The IMA is having this. This is one of the most important artists in the world. And then the other half of the population are going, what are you talking about? Who is this guy?
Who is Ai Weiwei?
Yeah.
Which is actually the theme of our pre-marketing campaign. We're going to try to pepper about the city some little stickers and T-shirts that says that say, who is Ai Weiwei? Who is he is an important question. And I think also to identify that he's that Ai Weiwei is a person, number
mm-hmm.
one,
right.
which who establishes. Mm-hmm. But for those who know, they do know that he is a very prominent political figure, mm-hmm. activist, dissident, and also an artist. And a lot of people know him from his three-month detention mm-hmm. when he was detained by the Chinese government in 2011. And there was a very vocal protest against that detention. And he was eventually released. But a lot of people know him as a humanitarian, as a rights activist, and they don't necessarily know what his art looks like.
Yeah.
His work hasn't been seen that much in the United States.
That's the part that's really interesting to me about this. I mean, there's been a lot of coverage about him, and there was a great profile in The New Yorker maybe a year ago. There's a documentary that PBS did that, in fact, has run here on WFYI just during the past month, and other coverage. I mean, even I think it was last year when the Nobel Prizes were being given out, there was talk of, will Ai Weiwei get this prize or not? You know, and it didn't happen, but still was, you know, I mean, the fact that, you know, his name was being, you know, put out there. But again, it's all about sort of the ideas behind his work and not necessarily his work. And in some ways, that's almost appropriate because so much of his work is very conceptual.
It is.
And let me ask you this, Sarah, because I mean, you know his work better than I do, and I've been learning more about it, though, and I've become a big fan. I'm so excited to see the show. But it seems as though a lot of his work, even though it was he trained as a visual artist initially and was living in New York back in the 80s, early 90s, it didn't seem like his work became political until maybe the past 5-6 years. I mean, he was always sort of conceptual and edgy and would push buttons and mm-hmm. maybe more trying to be a provocateur of the art world than the political world. But
he has been an activist mm-hmm. for a while, I think, is because his father was a very well-known poet and intellectual, I Ching, and he and his family were exiled during the Cultural Revolution. You know, his life has been political from the start, let's say.
Yeah.
But when he and his family returned to Beijing in the late 70s, pretty much right away, I became involved in sort of pro-democracy actions and also organizing with artists to promote free speech and the rights of artists. So it has been a thread throughout his life, but yes, he has become more active. And it's funny that you say 2005 or, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, because that's when he actually started blogging for the first time.
And that's really been such a huge part of his work. I mean, his presence on Twitter, his blogs. Tell me more about that.
I think he's always been an activist, but discovering the internet and really harnessing the power of the internet has given him a much louder voice. He started a blog in 2005. And then blogged just almost obsessively until 2009 when his blog was taken down. And it's been a really, really important outlet for him and a platform for promoting human rights and different issues in contemporary Chinese culture.
And that's really, I mean, so much about his work is about now, is looking at human rights issues in China, sort of calling attention to sometimes the absurdity of how the Chinese government deals with human rights issues.
Well, and I think in a wider sense, you know, he's looking at contemporary Chinese society and he's trying to grapple with the predicaments that accompany it. I think throughout the show, you see works that are about the tremendous change that's occurred in China over the past several decades, the change that's occurred in cities, the destruction of traditional neighborhoods and architecture to literally pave over to make way for modern buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, another earlier political work that he did was from 1995, and that was dropping a Han Dynasty urn.
Now, this image is pretty famous.
It is.
And I remember, I mean, I just was blown away by it the first time I saw it, just because it's a great image, even before I knew the value or the history of that urn that he was dropping and is crashing on the pavement in front of him, and he's sort of got this nonplussed look on his face as he's doing that. Tell me more about that piece.
So the piece is a photographic triptych. So it's three photos. You see him holding the Han Dynasty urn, and then you see it drop in midair, and then you see it crash to the ground. And, you know, a Han Dynasty urn is over 2,000 years old. It's an antiquity. It's valued. It has a very high value on the Chinese antiquity market.
Sure.
And to drop
it's a
it,
cultural icon. Clearly he knows what he's doing by dropping it. I mean,
he does.
It wasn't like he just, you know, knocked it over by accident.
His cousin is an expert in antiquities, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And I think this, again, is connected to him thinking about the changes that are occurring in China. China has such a long history and a rich history. And he's asking very provocatively, what are we doing? Our cities are being destroyed, are being remade. And yes, you know, reform is good in some ways, but it's also bad in others. And so what, you know, in destruction can also be a creative act.
Because he's making artwork by destroying another work of art.
He is. He is. And that's not unprecedented in the history of art.
So it still upsets a lot of people.
It does. It does. And it raises questions. Actually, the full title of the exhibition is Ai Weiwei, According to What? And that is the title of a 1964 painting by Jasper Johns. And when Ai Weiwei first encountered the work of Jasper Johns, he saw it in a book before he lived in the U.S., and he thought it was so ridiculous that an artist would include real paintbrushes or real items in a painting, and he thought that it wasn't art. And he threw it away. He remembers throwing away a Jasper Johns book. And it wasn't until his time in the U.S. when he started to really reconsider that that he became really intrigued by that issue of what is art, you know, is it, and who says it's art and who says it's valuable. You know, there's other works that he's done where he's dipping Neolithic vases into industrial paint.
Right, right. Very bright colors. And those works are going to be on exhibit, right,
as part
of this show.
They are. Very shown very near the dropping of the urn photos. And in a similar way, I think he's asking what's authentic, what's fake, and who determines that.
Now, tell me how the show was put together, because Ai Weiwei will not be coming to the United States for the show. He is in China right now. I believe he's still detained there. He's not allowed to leave the country.
He hasn't been given his passport back now, so he can't come, unfortunately.
This exhibit just closed at the Hirshhorn, is now coming to the IMA, is going to a couple other stops on a North American tour. How did this exhibit come about? Has he been involved in it?
Definitely. This show originated at the Mori Art Museum in Tokyo, and the curator's name is Mami Katowaka. And the show was originally held in 2009. And of course, a lot's happened between 2009 and now, when it opened at the Hirshhorn in DC. And so the curator of the show worked directly with I to formulate what the show should be. And it's quite different. And he thought about it. He thought about the works and what would be relevant for an American audience.
And this is the first major show of his work in the United States.
It is. Yeah. It is. His work has been seen, but in smaller groupings. And this is really the first major retrospective to travel in North America.
So. Again, kind of awesome that we have it at the IMA. I mean that's really cool.
So.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, I mean, for people who are familiar with his work and understand his significance, you know, in the art world right now, he is one of the most important, you know, artists working today. And so to have this, you know, this first show here in the United States, the second stop being the IMA, I mean, when I heard it was announced, I was just blown away. I was thrilled by it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you responded that way. Yeah, his work is very important, and I think we have a really sophisticated art audience here, and also, you know, this work appeals to an art audience, but it also appeals to people who are interested in things happening around the world. You know, Ai Weiwei is confronting really universal issues about freedom of speech, about human rights, about the changing and modernization of cities, and these are things that are relevant to a very wide group of people.
Now, so much of his work now is, it doesn't create necessarily a physical object. It is conceptual, as we talked about somewhat. I mean, when he was still able to do his blog, some of the stuff he's done with Twitter and other social media. How is that being conveyed in the show?
Well, one thing that we are going to have in our display that was not at the Hirshhorn is we've developed an iPad app that you'll be able to interact with in the galleries that really sort of fleshes out the other side of his life, learning more about his activities outside of art making. And also we've posed a series of questions to him that he's created video answers to that you'll be able to see and then add your response. So that's something that we've really tried to do to increase the context for it. But also, you know, you'll see a lot of his outside interests in the work. Something that he's made a lot of artworks about is the 2008 Sichuan earthquake disaster.
Right.
And he started a citizens investigation through the internet and through his blog originally. That was an effort to gather the names of the many school children who died in shoddily constructed schoolhouses in that region. And
And that was such a, in some ways, a radical activity, because the names were not being released. The Chinese government was not admitting exactly how many children were killed in that earthquake.
That's right.
Just by collecting those names became quite a political act. Where
That's
it seems
right.
like such a simple thing. But...
Right. And you know, such a seemingly uncontroversial thing to try to memorialize these children. But I think it was mostly an attempt to not place blame anywhere because of those poorly constructed schools. And yeah, a lot of people think that that's why his blog was shut down, even though it was never clearly articulated. But that list of names will be in the galleries. There's almost a Vietnam War memorial type wall that is a list of those names, along with the children's birth date and the grade of school that they were in. But in some ways, you know, that is an artwork that's on the wall, of course. But there's a more physical sculpture that will be in the same space that is dealing with those issues in a different way. He also collected a lot of mangled rebar from the destroyed schoolhouses, and he took it back to his studio and worked with many people over the course of a long time to straighten each of those twisted sections of rebar, and they will be arranged on the floor in a very minimal landscape that is its own memorial to the children who died.
One of the things that he does, I mean, working with so many other people that are part of his studio, collaborators, at least in the physical making of the work as well.
Yeah, he's less concerned about being the creator in a formal sense. I mean, he is a conceptual artist. They're his ideas. But I think he deals with that issue differently than, say, artists associated with minimalism in the U.S. who would draw up a plan for something and give it to an industrial fabricator.
Sure.
Ai Weiwei works with traditional Chinese artisans for the most part. I mean, you know, he worked with construction workers, let's say, for the rebar piece. But for some of his earlier sculptures from the 90s, where he's remaking pieces of antique furniture, he will hire traditional craftsmen and woodworkers and use very fine joinery techniques. And it's part of his concern to kind of celebrate those craftsmen and those techniques and promote them.
Well, in one, I think it was article I was reading, I really got a sense that, I mean, people love him because he pushes the boundaries, he pokes at the government, but he also is a great employer.
I mean, right.
you know, which is
yeah, you can't deny that.
Yeah, a very important thing. I know that. I mean, obviously, you've got this campaign. You know, who is Ai Weiwei? But once the exhibit opens, there's also going to be a number of other things going on that sort of, I think, will help audiences understand more about Ai Weiwei, film events and other activities as well.
Right. We will be screening the same documentary that you mentioned that you've screened at WFYI. That will be showing several times over a weekend in May. We'll have our opening night event that will be on Thursday, April 4th.
Right when the show airs.
Tonight. is bringing in two experts, Lee Ambrosi, who actually edited the book Ai Weiwei's Blog, that is the English translations of all of his blog posts that were then taken down.
Travis DiNicola with the IMA's contemporary art curator, Sarah Green. For more information, visit imamuseum.org, imamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll learn about a fashion exhibit that features the wardrobes of first ladies at the President Benjamin Harrison Home.
I'll get a preview of an upcoming writers' conference, The Right Stuff, at the Palladium.
And I'll talk with singer Karen Irwin about her Janis Joplin tribute. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we call What Do We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.